Welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is Lyle Goldstein, Director for Asia Engagement at Defense Priorities and a visiting professor at Brown University. Lyle, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, John. I'm a very big fan of this podcast.
Thanks very much. We're going to be talking about great power competition, as it's referred to in policy discussions. Just to start us out, in a big picture kind of way, talk a little bit about what the U.S. approach to Russia and China has been in this kind of era of what policymakers are calling great power competition. How are the approaches similar to each country, different? How should they be different given their different situations and so on?
Yeah, that's there's a lot there. Let me see if I can unpack each piece. I mean, generally, I would say, it's important to state up front that great power competition, has always been there. I've never known a period in my life where we didn't have that. I mean, arguably during a few years after the Gulf War, there was a little bit of respite and things calmed down. But I mean, it's easy to remember when I was first starting my career at Naval War College. I'm no longer there, but when I first started there, it was one reason I think I was hired was there was this incident in the South China Sea where a U.S. and Chinese aircraft collided. Unfortunately, the Chinese pilot was killed. But I mean, that, clearly signaled a kind of new step. There were other steps, but, I cannot remember a time when we were not in a sort of great power competition. And then, of course, all the issues with Russia. So, yes, from a kind of branding point of view and having worked for DOD, I can say DOD likes branding very much. It basically helps to align everybody behind the same set of goals. So I would also say not to psychoanalyze too much, but I think that people in DOD wanted to turn a page on the whole fiasco in Afghanistan and the Iraq War and a lot of failed interventions in the Middle East. And this great power competition was a very easy way to say, hey, folks, been there, done that. We're finished with these kind of small interventions. Now we're hunting big game. And, those require big thinking, big ticket items, very clever strategies and so forth. So, I mean, I most of this I view as kind of branding, powers. The great powers are always in competition. This never stopped. It shall always be. I'm a realist, and that's how I see it. I mean, is it intensifying? Absolutely. Yes, there is an intensification here because of the war in Ukraine. And just to get to the last part of your question, treating them differently. Yes, I think we do need to think quite differently about the two challenges. I don't think we should overestimate Russian weakness, clearly, but on the other hand, I and others have noted Russia has a economy that, or Russia's defense spending, for example, is about 1/20th of NATO aggregate, right? So to me, we have long overestimated Russian military power. We should be much more relaxed about it and less, obsessed with it and with containing Russia. On China is much more formidable competitor, if you will. I'm not saying anything. I'm not teaching your listeners here anything. They all know that. Its economy is extremely robust. I've spent a lot of time in China walking around, second, third, fourth tier cities. And I can tell you the Chinese economy is not, it is robust and dynamic. We shouldn't underestimate China at all. That said, though, China, in many ways, is self-confident. They have acted, I think, with a good amount of restraint. So, whereas Russia has felt the need to resort to force with greater frequency. So, there are a lot of nuances here, and we'd be very foolish to kind of treat them as great power X and Y.
So I appreciate the kind of long view of history that you gave us and reminding us that this kind of competition is kind of endemic in the international system. The policy discourse on it these days seems pretty broad to me. People are trying to imagine how this era of competition could be different than past ones. But I find it interesting that traditional kind of territorial disputes with each of these great powers is a major part of the relationship that's unfolding. So, for example, Russia has gripes about NATO enlargement in Europe and, lashes out in Georgia and Ukraine and so on. China has territorial and maritime disputes in the South China Sea and also has this problem of the Taiwan issue, which we'll get to. And so I want to talk about these territorial disputes for a little bit. Let's start with Russia, given the ongoing war. What's your assessment of Russia's motivations in Ukraine? And to what extent has U.S. policy contributed to those motivations?
Okay, well, thanks. Yeah, well, let's dig in on the war in Ukraine and its origins, so forth. I'll give you my general take. And like everybody else who is, well, I think everybody on the planet practically is absolutely disturbed and we're repulsed. It's abhorrent, the incredible carnage. So many children, so many orphans now. So I think like most Americans, I'm strongly condemning, this horrible act of aggression. But I think we're being intellectually dishonest if we don't to recognize that, that NATO expansion and NATO activities have had a major role in creating this horrible outcome. So, here I guess I would strongly agree with thinkers like Mearsheimer and Walt and others and many people in the restraint community who are drawing attention to the notion that NATO played a role. I go back to George Kennan, one of my heroes in realist thought, who stated absolutely emphatically in, I think it was 1999 interview with Tom Friedman, where he in the New York Times, you can just Google that, and he says very clearly, if we go forward with NATO expansion, this will absolutely cause a new Cold War. It will foment a horrible reaction by Russian nationalists, which it certainly has done. So he was right on point. And I worked very hard during the last 5 or 6 years. I had spent most of my time working on China during my career at Naval War College, but I really tried to reorient and devoted a lot of effort to propose some solutions to the Donbass crisis. For example, I wrote an article in January 2020, maybe you can link it for your viewers, where I appraised the first meeting between Putin and Zelensky that was in the Normandy format together with Merkel and Macron. And this was a really stunning moment, right? Where you had all these four leaders together talking intensively about what to do about Donbass. And I said, look, folks, it wasn't a great meeting, but it was a decent meeting. We can make this work. If we take certain steps, we can find some kind of compromise in Donbass, basically a way to make the Minsk Accord work. So, I'm horribly, and by the way, the bottom line of my recommendation was the U.S. really has to engage as a peacemaker here and stop kind of, encouraging some of the escalation dynamics. And it's really regrettable that got much further out of hand since 2020 and a huge opportunity was lost. Let's not forget, Zelensky was elected as a peacemaker. He promised when he was elected, and he was elected with an overwhelming majority, he promised to do a deal with Putin to end the war. So it's just this horrible irony that here he is now celebrated today as a wartime leader when he was elected to be a peacemaker. And so many opportunities for diplomacy missed. I fear that the United States, could have done much more for peace. And now, just to give my bottom line up front, that I think very much, we're seeing huge carnage and destruction and death on a massive scale. I would submit maybe perhaps as many as 50,000 are already dead. I say, are we going to wait for another 100,000 to die before we consider peace proposals? I would like to see lots of peace proposals on the table. Let's see what we can make stick to prevent this destruction from continuing.
You mentioned escalation dynamics there as a result of U.S. policy. Can you be specific and kind of tease that out for us? What about our policies have contributed to that escalation dynamic, and what should we do differently to ratchet it down?
Yeah. And here, you know, I'm not one of those who's going to claim that this was all on our side. I think this was a kind of multi-headed hydra, and, you know, Putin, you know, I've studied Putin for many years, and he is somebody who not only is obsessed with security, we all know that, but he's obsessed with Russian pride. Many of his impulses, I do think, are irrational, you know, probably suffered from overconfidence and thought that because his use of force in the past was successful, that he could do it again. So, I mean, you know, there are many, you know, he obviously deserves, you know, a lot of blame for this tragedy, unquestionably. And, you know, many people have said he's kind of surrounded by yes men and so forth. So, you know, there are, I agree with most of those reasons as major causes of the conflict. But on the other side, you know, we also need to take some responsibility. And, you know, this is, you know, even in the New York Times, this has been said multiple times here, even by Tom Friedman, who actually brought up the Kennan quote. He brought it up a few days after the invasion started, said, hey, folks, you know, we're partly responsible. And he's right. So concretely, though, you know, I saw this from my own eyes. And not only was I got a close look at all the activities that the U.S. and NATO were involved in Ukraine, and more or less what we saw in the during the couple few years before the war was more or less a continuous rotation of exercises that looked an awful lot like Ukraine was being prepared for NATO membership across the board. And this was very disturbing to Russians, both at a real practical level, you know, but also at a symbolic level. And, you know, one other specific example I would mention would be, you know, I deal a lot with naval strategy, right? I taught at Naval War College for 20 years. And there, what we saw was, you know, U.S. taxpayer money, a lot of it going to upgrade all the piers in Odessa. And, you know, they were upgraded to a NATO standard so that they would be able to hold NATO warships, you know, who would be visiting a lot, presumably. And so the Russians watched all this and, you know, found that, you know, horribly humiliating. I think Putin even mentioned this in his speech right before the war. That was essentially his declaration of war, but he was extremely agitated that Odessa was being basically outfitted as a NATO base for, you know, to enhance NATO maritime power in the Black Sea. So, you know, to me as a realist, that's just an absolutely clear violation of, like, where, you know, where you are really pushing for a maximalist kind of view of security that just runs very roughshod over any kind of concerns. You know, we could also talk about missile defenses and those Aegis facilities, Aegis Ashore, that went into both Romania and Poland. But the Russians repeatedly objected and objected and objected, and we just dismissed all their objections as you know, not relevant or not understanding what we were doing and so forth. But I mean, we neglected to see how all of these steps, you know, which none of them in itself was like a dramatic blow to Russian security, but taken in aggregate was seen by the Russians as like a massive conspiracy to build up Ukraine into this sort of fortress Ukraine that would forever contain and severely damage Russia's security interests. I mean, to state the obvious, and your viewers all know this, but just put it out there that I mean, you know, this is all happening, you know, a few hundred miles from Moscow and St. Petersburg or less. So, you know, we in the United States, we would never allow that kind of thing to happen. You know, as everyone has said over and over, if this was going on in Mexico, we would intervene in about 5 minutes. And I think that's absolutely true.
There have been serious costs to Russia in the war in terms of security, economic, diplomatic costs. But I wonder how you think this looks to China in the context of the Taiwan issue. Does China think it could avoid these costs? Does the war give China pause on Taiwan? What lessons do you think China's learning here?
Yeah, I've been watching this really carefully and trying to ascertain what are these lessons? I mean, you know, there are sort of operational tactical type lessons where I've seen China is clearly, although, you know, here China had very good proficiency with drone warfare, I should say. I mean, they're the leading drone maker in the world, actually. So it's not a stretch for them. But I mean, you know, I can see already in their exercise, they seem to be, I watch Chinese military news every single day. So I can tell you that as I watch their exercises, they're taking it up a few notches when it comes to the use of tactical drones, no question. Another area where I think they'll learn a lot in terms of tactics and operations, urban warfare. Clearly, Russia, you know, went in with certain assumptions, and I think, you know, their botched attempt to take Kiev and Kharkiv kind of showed the world and China in particular that seizing a city is, especially, you know, without destroying it, is an extremely difficult military operation. And the Chinese were already talking about urban warfare a lot and practicing extensively. So I think, you know, they were already, you know, perhaps even on par or above where Russia was at. But I think this shows them that you have a lot more, that this is incredibly difficult, and they'll have to think very carefully about how urban warfare would take place. After all, Taiwan does have a lot of big cities and a lot of large towns, so forth. But generally, you know, I would say my general takeaway is that, yes, China is sobered. You know, that's the conventional wisdom, and I think it's correct. How sobered are they? You know, I think, you know, does anybody think that they thought that Taiwan would be a walk in the park? No, I don't think Chinese ever thought that. Did they ever think they could just waltz into Taiwan and without, you know, having to kill a lot of people or destroy the island? No. In fact, I've seen, I think, quite earnest preparation on the Chinese side for what they would have to do to kind of clean up the rubble, if you will. And, you know, I'm not being flippant. I think they know they would have to, you know, essentially to rain down enormous destructive power. And by the way, that's one of the lessons for China is Russia kind of tried to, if you will, have their cake and eat it too, that they kind of wanted to intimidate the Ukrainians, hoping they wouldn't fight. And so I think they went in kind of with a sort of, if you will, I know it didn't seem this way, but they kind of tried not to rain down destruction on, you know, you know, even the center of Kiev, for example, today is not, has hardly been touched. The outskirts of Kiev are severely damaged, but not the center. So there was an attempt to kind of go in light handed, and that failed miserably. And now the Russians have kind of recorrected and they're going to the opposite extreme, which is terrible, of course, for the people who live in these cities in Mariupol and other places. I fear that China, one of China's lessons is, you know, that they absolutely, will need to use a extremely high level of coercion and destruction. So that's very disturbing. And, you know, other lessons China's learning here, you know, include, I think, on the issue of surprise, for example. We all know, you know, Russia failed miserably in its kind of strategic, operational, tactical surprise, just on all counts. So I suppose we must give U.S. intelligence agency some credit there, you know, the various analysts in D.C. who divined from an early point that this really was a real invasion. In the case of Taiwan, I think China will be, they understood already that to accomplish an amphibious invasion, they would need to achieve some very high level of surprise. So I think this is something China is quite good at, right? If we look across the cases of Chinese uses of force, and I think they're studying the Ukraine war to see exactly what they would have to do in order to achieve surprise. We can talk about, you know, the mechanics of that, but I think they are real. And I think China, you know, how to put it, even more than with Russia, China has the ability to cloak its actions and hide capabilities. After all, that's one of their famous, very famous phrases, actually, that they are you know, going back to Deng Xiaoping, Chinese should be good at hiding their power. And I think they are quite good at that. So yeah, a lot of lessons for Taiwan. I fear that it's simply been delayed rather than canceled, unfortunately. And I do think, though, we can, if you want, we may shift to the question of what should we learn from this for a Taiwan issue, the Taiwan scenario. That's another good question we might also chat about.
Yeah, I think I'd ask a sort of comparable question here. You know, I'm going to ask you about the policy of strategic ambiguity, as it's referred to, and how we've had some recent presidents that have had some difficulty, let's say, clarifying that ambiguity, so to speak. But before we get there, I know this has been wargamed very thoroughly even before the Ukraine war. So what would a U.S. conflict with China over Taiwan look like?
Yes, this is something I've really spent the last 20 years working on, mostly at Naval War College. But, you know, I've concluded some years ago that this war would be very bloody, very tragic, and that the most important thing to keep in mind really are the geographical constraints on the one hand, and then the kind of asymmetry of will or the stakes for each country. So let's take those one at a time. I mean, both are very simple, but they really, in my view, these are the determinant factors. You know, no matter what kind of fancy new doctrine or technology or great weapon system you want to come up with, there is this problem that Taiwan is located just, you know, 90 miles off the shore of China. And, you know, from a strategy point of view, that just gives them incredible options to bring massive firepower at a very rapid rate. I mean, you know, we talk about surprise, for example. You have to mobilize for an invasion, right? You think a lot of that would be visible. But if a lot of the hardest punches that China intends to land against Taiwan are coming from missiles and bombers and helicopters, say, well, that all of that can be moved exceedingly quickly, you know, within hours. Okay, so I mean, I don't think we will have much warning. And, you know, I think that this probably the war, I mean, most likely it would be over rather quickly. Before the U.S. could even, if you will, make up its mind. I think that's one real scenario, because after all, the dilemmas are huge. And by the way, like everybody knows, China is a nuclear power. In my view, it's a robust nuclear power, that it has plenty of capability, hypersonic weapons, you know, MIRVs, you know, multiple reentry vehicles. You know, so I have no doubt that they can strike the continental United States with nuclear weapons. So, you know, of course, they're going to flex those nuclear muscles quite like Putin did in the opening phase of the war. So there's a good chance the U.S. would be deterred, that none of its forces would arrive. And those that did arrive would, even if they were highly effective, you know, take submarines, for example. We often talk about submarines. And here I've given a lot of thought to how could the U.S. submarine force act to defend Taiwan, but I've concluded that it's a bridge that's too far. There's too many constraints on our submarines. I mean, for example, submarines have a small magazine. That is, they have very limited number of weapons, and it's very difficult to reload the submarine. So you can't be reloaded on station. It has to return to a base somewhere. And of course, the Chinese know where all those bases are. So, you know, just with very crude kind of torpedo hit model, you can conclude that while U.S. Navy submarines in the area could put a lot of hurt on the Chinese Navy, that they would not have nearly enough firepower to impact a campaign of lasting 2 to 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And by that time, China would have a strong lodgment on the island and be flowing forces in that could not be interdicted. So my general thought here, and apologies if I've given you more detail than you wanted to know, but, you know, looking at the details of this is exceedingly important. And I just, to me, I see immense destruction. I see an island completely destroyed. I see China winning this war, perhaps at a very bloody cost. You know, casualties would be huge on both sides. And if the United States intervened, indeed, many thousands of Americans would die as well. Hopefully not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or more Americans. But it could, you know, there is a scenario where things go badly for China. And, you know, we do maybe succeed in the first rounds where this escalates and escalates and escalates until we trade cities or use tactical nuclear weapons, which is quite a live scenario, by the way, both in Ukraine, but also in the Taiwan scenario. So, yeah, John, this is, in summary, it's a very dark picture all around.
So given that dark picture, should we be rethinking strategic ambiguity? There's a whole history there, which you can go into if that's clarifying, but is it still a suitable posture for us?
Well, here's what I advise. Strategic ambiguity has some advantages. You know, these are very tough choices that the U.S. would have to make. And I think in some ways, you know, some kind of like, if we change ambiguity to clarity, I see huge downsides. I actually think that could ignite the war right away. In other words, the minute we say ambiguity is over, we're moving an armored division over to, you know, protect Taipei. At that moment, I think China would strike. That's what they've said they've done, they would do, and they would regard, you know, any move to put U.S. forces into Taiwan as a more or less a declaration of war. So that kind of clarity is highly dangerous. And by the way, that is one that is gaining currency in Washington. So I'm very concerned about that. You know, under strategic ambiguity, we can maintain some kind of influence on the situation and possibly encourage Taiwan quietly to arm itself. You know, in the way that Ukraine has done. You know, with lots of javelins and stingers and so forth. You know, one can imagine a kind of strategic clarity in the other direction, and here I think I would like to see an honest debate among Americans about this conflict and how it looks. And I think Americans are very, you know, gradually coming around to the point of view that just in the same way that we're very glad that President Biden ruled out war with Russia, that I think he would also rule out he and any likely president, once they had looked at how destructive, what were the nuclear risks and so forth, they would come to the conclusion that we should rule out a U.S.-China war over Taiwan. It's just too dangerous, too fraught with risk, too likely to cost a large amount of American lives for uncertain ends. So, you know, I do think that debate should be had, but I also think that it could be a bit destabilizing now to try to aim for a kind of strategic clarity that abandons Taiwan, as it were, throws them to the sharks. That's a bridge too far. But I mean, I do think some quiet discussions with leaders in Taipei have to be had, where they say, look, you know, look at what happened in Ukraine. You do not want this to happen to your island. You know, arguably the Ukrainians are doing extremely well, you know, under the circumstances, and yet still their country has been destroyed, more or less. They're you know, they're dependent on foreigners for assistance, and you know, really what is absolutely necessary, and here, you know, I would like to underline this point, that could wiser leadership in Kiev have found a compromise? I think so. You know, neutrality. You know, and here Taiwan leaders should look at this and say, hey, well, you know, maybe neutrality, as it were, is a better course. Maybe seeking compromise with the mainland, maybe this can be done. People often forget the leaders of Taiwan and China met quite recently at the end of 2015. It was an important moment. It was an amicable meeting, actually much better than the Putin-Zelensky meeting. So, I mean, there is, people often forget that there are actual diplomatic tools that can be used to solve this dispute. I would like to see, you know, instead of American diplomats saying, oh, we have nothing to say on this issue, you know, of this relationship. No, I don't think that's right. We should use our influence to try to help find a diplomatic compromise. And, if we put some energy at this and some thought, I think that could be done. And strategic ambiguity would permit that, in my view, and could allow that to go forward. But it requires some, as it were, some tough love with our friends in Taipei.
China has also been securing permission from other countries and territories for military bases and equipment there. There's recent reporting about the Solomon Islands and Cambodia, and policymakers are watching this and trying to discern what China's intentions might be there. How do you see that?
Yeah, a lot of chatter about this, and it seems like China is sort of poking its head into every kind of part of the world. You know, really, anywhere you look now, you can see Chinese influence. Well, it's not a surprise to me. I mean, China, in my view, has the largest economy on earth. I mean, if you go by the nominal numbers, the U.S. economy is still number one, but by the if you use purchasing power parity, another methodology for measuring economies, by the way, used by the World Bank, Goldman Sachs, and a lot of leading economists take this PPP methodology more seriously, you see that China's economy is already substantially larger. And, you know, as a result, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that China's the largest trading partner of so many countries, even in Latin America these days, which is a bit shocking. But so no surprise, really, to see China kind of involved in all the countries all over the world, really. Yes, there has been some indication that there might be, you know, more Chinese military bases abroad. Right now, we have one official Chinese military base abroad. This one is in East Africa, Djibouti. And, you know, we could talk about Djibouti. I think China's been learning some lessons from that. But, you know, I try to keep, you know, we've got to see the larger context for this, right? The U.S. has, I think, over 700 military facilities abroad, 700, folks, and China has one now. So, you know, I think if we retain some perspective, realize that China is a superpower. Some people don't like to use that word. I have no problem using that word at all. You know, there are many areas in which China already exceeds American power. So we just have to get used to this idea of sharing the world, that China is indeed going to be a global power. If we're smart, we'll use restraint and try to steer China in a constructive direction. And I don't think that has to be so hard. I mean, there's a lot of good evidence that China is already steering itself in that direction. I mean, look at how much they've done on UN peacekeeping. It's very impressive. I mean, did you know China has soldiers in places, dangerous places, you know, like Lebanon, for example? They're pulling a lot of mines out of the ground in Lebanon. That's really important work. So, I mean, there's, you know, I could give you many examples, but there's reason to believe, you know, that we can share the world with China, that China can be a kind of responsible actor on the world stage. So we should be encouraging all these impulses, really. And by losing our heads or having our hair on fire every time we hear about, you know, the possibility of a Chinese base somewhere, I think that's very wrongheaded and leads us down into this kind of dangerous escalation spiral, which is it's the opposite of what I recommended. I recommended in my book, my 2015 book on U.S.-China relations, I recommended something I call it cooperation spiral, where we both kind of outline our long-term what we want to see and work together with China here. And now we see the opposite of these escalation spirals. You see that going on in the Solomons here, but I think it's quite, you know, it's so premature and very wrongheaded, I think, to view that as a threat. China would have to, you know, take much more aggressive moves to be anything like a threat there. Now, look, I know in World War II, we fought a huge battle, a massive, battle of attrition with Japan in that same area. And I think that is, you know, if the Chinese were smarter, they would have realized that this was probably not a great spot to get to work here because of those emotional ties to the Solomon Islands that we have. But I just do not see any kind of major threat forming here. I mean, remember, one of the major reasons we fought that battle with Japan was to prevent Japan from cutting us off from Australia. But Australia today is a very powerful country, and you know, they don't need our defense. really. And they would, even if cut off momentarily somehow, you know, in the worst case scenario, they would fight very well independently and so forth. It's really the North Pacific that matters more for the United States, Japan, and the kind of broader balance of power there in terms of holding our position. So the South Pacific, in my view, is we shouldn't get a be in a bonnet over, you know, the Chinese playing around here and there. You know, one more thing I'll say that is, look, things have changed since the 1930s and 40s when those islands were absolutely critical to, you know, that's how you move step by step across the Pacific. It's just not like that anymore. We have nuclear submarines today. They don't need, you know, coaling stations or, you know, it's more or less they can fight independently. And moreover, with precision strike weapons, you can more or less destroy any kind of fixed base. So we shouldn't overestimate the use of like any one facility. It's better just to have kind of a broad network of places, as I say, places, not bases. I don't see a huge danger of China kind of building up some kind of facility. But the point is, we would have plenty of time to watch and recalibrate if we had to, you know, if China was becoming much more aggressive or if these facilities subsequently were seen as a threat. But in the meantime, we should be more relaxed and try to engage China in a kind of cooperative approach. By the way, Djibouti is an interesting place. I'll just comment quickly. This is China's base in East Africa. Guess what? It's located right next to an American base. And I think that was by design. I mean, you know, if they were up to something incredibly nefarious, they wouldn't have put it next to an American base because they know that we would know exactly what's going on there. So they wanted us to know what was going on there. And they wanted, you know, and by the way, France and Japan also have facilities there and other countries. So, I mean, I think that's maybe the best way to view this is like, you know, could the U.S. and China cooperate in Africa, for example? Possibly. Well, if our bases are almost co-located, it makes some sense. So, you know, I could give you some more examples of this, but there are ways that we can conceive of where the U.S. and China are actually partners in international security and not kind of rivals and hypothetical or potential enemies. We really need to recalibrate our thinking on that and not fall into this, you know, look, I think I've heard on your podcast, and so forth, you know, human people are very prone to kind of xenophobic kind of rivalry. That's kind of how our minds are trained by evolution to think in this very suspicious way, you know, in-group, out-group thinking and so forth. So this will easily lead us astray and into a awful, catastrophic set of wars that could be nuclear wars. So we have to fight against this tendency and see the possibilities for cooperation, which I think are there, actually.
I've been following your work for years, and I know you have a great depth of expertise in both Russia and China. But I do want to ask you about India and how India plays into all this great power competition. I believe India is being courted in a certain sense by Russia, China, and the United States in different ways. How do you see that dynamic, and what do you think makes sense for the United States there?
Yeah, I mean, India is a very interesting wild card in international affairs. You know, I think this is a country that has enormous potential. You know, everybody knows that. Again, we've seen, you know, we all know we don't just like Indian food, but India's economy is doing amazing things in areas like IT. And, you know, I know American investors are very excited about India, and rightly so. I mean, the country has a lot of problems, of course, but I fully expect, you know, that India possibly could outpace China along a lot of metrics. Again, if you use those PPP methods for looking out, you know, decades in the future, you know, the trends all point to that India might well exceed China in, both in population, but also in GDP. So, I mean, at the end of my 2015 book, I really try to look out into that world where the U.S. is not a minor power, but it really is India and China that are the really global superpowers at that point. And I do think, in a way, we do have to plan for that kind of future. Now, will they be, you know, rivals on the verge of war with each other, or will they be, you know, develop a more kind of, you know, working kind of pragmatic relationship? I hope for the latter. And I think if the U.S. was wise, instead of trying at every point to turn India against China, I think we would be much more enlightened if we tried to encourage the two Asian giants to start to cooperate and realize that, you know, fighting over, you know, this terrain in the Himalayas, you know, where they have glaciers and you know, it's an incredibly a hostile kind of terrain, picturesque, but extremely difficult and really not worth fighting over. I mean, there's no arable land or anything up there, and it's really very difficult to maintain troops up on that frontier. So, I mean, you know, I don't think either country really, really wants to be in a constant battle up there, committing huge resources to maintaining massive formations of troops up there on the in the Himalayas. But I mean, they're kind of driven by nationalism and rivalry to do so. So, but and I mean, this could get much, much worse, unquestionably, if China and India come to blows. So, I would like to see our policy. Here I think we need a little less realpolitik, and we should try to. And I think China would become a little less paranoid if they saw that we were not constantly trying to push use India as a kind of chess piece. And by the way, I don't think the Indians appreciate being used as a chess piece either. I think we have fomented some, kind of a backlash in India that we maybe are seeing in the Ukraine war, that, you know, where we may have liked the Indians to sign up right along with us as we hope, because we were calling them a great democratic, you know, ally. And yet they've taken a very, contradictory approach here. And they've said they're not going to break their relationship with Russia, which is very tight. Now, Russia is trying to kind of pull India and China together, kind of, if you will, in a more anti-American alignment. But they certainly want to keep, you know, they do not want to give up on India, although they've been making inroads with Pakistan now, too, I think, at China's behest a bit. But it's a complicated picture. But, you know, to me, this all points to multipolarity. And multipolarity, you know, a lot of international relations theorists are very uneasy about multipolarity because they think it's unstable. But I think there are some real virtues here too. And that generally what it can mean is that we decrease the potential for rivalry and escalation, right? In a bipolar world, you know, if it's the US and China or the US against China and Russia here, you know, looks a lot like the 1950s. And remember the 1950s, it was just crisis after crisis after crisis, and each one more dangerous than the next till we got to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we don't want to go back there, folks, but that's kind of where we are right now. This is looking a lot like the 1950s. This time, of course, China is much more powerful than back then, but it's similarly dangerous. And I think India, you know, I would like to see India stand up more on the world stage, you know, get much more involved in peacekeeping, peacemaking. I had even, you know, back in that article I wrote in January 2020 about the Donbass issue and how to maybe solve this Ukraine crisis for once and for all, I said, let Asia take the lead. Let's see Chinese and Indian troops, maybe with Japanese peacekeeping troops in the Donbass. You know, they can accomplish some good because the Russians will not allow European peacekeepers to go into Donbass. So, you know, could you imagine, John, India and China working together on the world stage to make peace in volatile areas? I think that's a future I could sign up for.
You do a lot of military and security analysis, but I wonder if you think we're focusing our competitive edge in the wrong areas. Is it better to broaden the notion of how we effectively compete, bringing in economic growth and scientific progress and education and making our domestic features more attractive, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. I really agree with that. And that's one reason I like Cato so much is our country has so much going for it, with so many, and so many people look to us as leaders. I mean, even in, you know, I can say, having spent a lot of time in China and Russia, there are so many people that admire our country. They truly do. And not just in the, you know, even in leadership circles. So we have so much going for us. We've just somehow seemed to step in it all the time, if you will. And I do think, you know, the restraint community, needs to stand up robustly and try to fight against these impulses toward militarism and rivalry. and we need to rededicate ourselves to, you know, our founding vision of our country. You know, everybody should go read Washington's final address and so forth, and you know, realize the strengths of our country, you know, and appreciate that. Kennan and thinkers like that said, you want to be a leader in the world, you want to have influence, then set a good example. That's certainly the best way to do it. Let's make our country, you know, as free as possible and as, you know, prosperous and equal, you know, in other words, share the wealth and make ourselves an example. And we have done that throughout our history, but we've sort of fallen off the wagon here. And now, you know, the U.S. is, I think, lagging in many indicators here. So I think we have to rediscover that. But part of that is has to be a kind of restraint-oriented set of policies where we're not intervening all across the globe all the time and getting ourselves involved in everybody's business. And you know, I honestly, as I look at the most dangerous flashpoints today, whether it's Korean Peninsula, but really the Taiwan issue and Ukraine, these are exceedingly dangerous. I mean, both have, all of those issues have major nuclear shadows. You know, and I don't think the U.S. has major national security interests. That is, our security is not vitally threatened in any of these situations. So we can play the role of, you know, coming up with great ideas to diffuse the tensions, but we do not have to actively engage, certainly not with our military forces, but we should also not be, you know, squandering our national wealth in these horrible and intractable conflicts, which, after all, we have to let the people who live in these regions settle them themselves, you know, and that's very difficult to kind of not be in control of everything. But this is, as we all know, this is a problem in Washington that we restrainers are trying to work on.
One of the through lines in this discourse is the risk of a U.S. policy that's tough towards both Russia and China, and therefore kind of pushing them together. And I want to ask a few questions about that. You have written that, quote, de-dollarization may be another economic result of a consolidated Russia-China quasi-alliance. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, sure. I am really focused on Russia-China relations now. It was a big topic before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but it's maybe even a bigger topic now. I've been writing a book on this issue for the last couple of years. So I wonder if I'll have to throw a few chapters out, but I think I'm okay. But it's hugely important. And unquestionably, there is a very, I think the coalescing of Moscow and Beijing continues, maybe slightly different trajectory now. And there are some new dynamics here after the war, but this is a formidable relationship. I think many people don't appreciate how broad it is, but also how deep it is. So, we can talk about the different aspects of it. But to address your question about de-dollarization there, I mean, there are some economic consequences of what we're seeing today. And you know, there is a question of how far China will go to support Russia. And my answer generally is it will go quite far, but, you know, at the same time, trying to protect its corporate interests. So, you know, they are walking a bit of a fine line. But one of the economic results is we could say de-dollarization, because it a lot of the transactions, you'd be shocked that Chinese and Russians were doing a lot of transactions in dollars formerly. But now that's all switching, and they're using the Chinese yuan or renminbi, if you will. And this may be expanded to encompass other countries, if you will, along the Belt and Road. Iran has shown a lot of interest in this. So, you know, what we're seeing is gradually developing a group of countries that you know, don't use American dollars at all. And now I actually think that we don't want to get too upset about this myself, because I actually think that the strength of the dollar has been somewhat problematic for the U.S. economy. That's a whole different discussion, John. But But yes, I mean, in a way, you could argue that the one impact of all these sanctions and we seem to sanction everybody everywhere at this point. Oh, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's really incredible how often we resort to the sanctions tool. But one impact of this is that, you know, any country that has some disagreements with the U.S. is wise, you know, to think about how to avoid these vulnerabilities associated with a lot of use of dollars. So yeah, in effect, we are helping de-dollarization. But of course, the Russia-China, if I call it a quasi-alliance, but this meeting of the minds here is an important factor in world affairs. I think, you know, already we could see the Ukraine war would be substantially different if China wasn't kind of lending its support in many ways to Russia. You know, some have gone as far as to say that Putin visited China in order to get a green light. You know, is that true or not? We can debate that. I'm a little skeptical there, but the claim has been made. And we can talk about, you know, does China benefit or not? This is a big debate among China specialists these days. But where would you like to go on discussing this relationship, John?
Well, let's just, you've also written that on the military security side, relations between China and Russia are thoroughly institutionalized. So there are both economic and military consequences. And I just wonder if you have any ideas about how to break that dynamic where we're pushing China and Russia together in this way.
Yeah, it may well be too late. You know, this didn't start yesterday, as you know. I mean, we started our sort of pivot toward the Pacific, you know. Really, we can go as far back as the 90s and early 2000s. We were already building up on Guam. So, you know, China for a long time thinks that the U.S. is out to contain it and therefore is inclined to look for friends in the world like Russia. And Russia, you know, arguably, and the argument was made, I think, as recently as the Trump administration. There, I remember John Bolton was sent on a mission to Moscow, and he was, I think, if I recall, this would have been around 2017 or something. He was supposed to explain to Vladimir Putin why China is the real threat. And I remember reading the Russian papers at the time, and they were all kind of laughing at Bolton for making this attempt, you know, to pull Russia so brazenly away from China. Was that really conceivable? From a simple question, you can say, what does Russia gain from making an enemy of China? You know, that would be exceedingly dangerous approach to take. And I think Russia now realizes, you know, they know how strong China is. And while in the back of their minds, they may have some kind of fear of China, but I mean, Putin has pretty strongly said, you know, he's not going to tolerate an anti-China approach. And he may have, you know, the Russian leadership at times has shown, you know, a disposition to, they don't want to be too dependent on China. They want a strong relationship with Japan, South Korea, you know, different other countries out there, Vietnam and India, of course, you brought that up before. So anyway, the point is, after the last 10 years, or if you will, 20 years even of this growing great power competition, you know, I think the alignment between Russia and China is, like I said, very deep, very broad. And so the idea that, you know, this could be changed very quickly, or that suddenly Xi Jinping would wake up and say, gosh, Putin, what a reckless guy. You know, I think we need to rethink this whole thing. That was very, very unrealistic. And I think even those who have argued that this is just a marriage of convenience, that was very brittle kind of relationship, I think, did not realize that actually the relationship, you know, it has security benefits for both. It has diplomatic benefits. You know, I've looked on the Korean Peninsula. They cooperate closely in Latin America, Central Asia, Africa, you name it. And economically, you know, this is for China. You know, Russia is like this treasure storehouse of resources to feed China's kind of endless appetite for resources. And Russia is increasingly looks to China as kind of a model, which is a bit shocking because the Russians have always had this kind of condescending attitude toward China. But increasingly, they are much more respectful and thinking, gee, how can we benefit here? And just on small things like just look how Russia has really come to understand that drones are essential in warfare, right? I mean, they, and guess who's the world leader in drone, you know, drone, making drones. You know, absolutely, they are kind of envious of China's position and want to learn from it. They don't, I don't see, you know, you could find the odd Russian leader who, or Russian pundit who was kind of anti-China. They're out there, and I do keep track of them, but they're more and more rare. And part of it is just easily explained that Russia has nowhere to go in the world. They're, you know, condemned by the West so thoroughly that now they have no choice at all. So, you know, I guess China's in the catbird seat, and they seem to want to hold Russia close for all the reasons I outlined above, but also because they know that Russia has kind of a common worldview with them. And it is remarkable how much their worldview lines up these days, that is between Beijing and Moscow.
Well, on that dismal note, thank you, Lyle Goldstein, for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed the visiting, and this is just a tremendous podcast. So keep up the great work, John.
Thanks, Lyle.